Okay, this is session 11, July 31st, 2006, side one, and we're going to continue with McLuhan on the right side of my book, and we're on page 17 of the book in the middle, and Scott's going to read the first quote, which comes from Take Today, a book that McLuhan wrote with Barry Nevitt, came out in 1972. He wrote it from 68 to 72, four-year process. So this quote is in italics. Now, wait a minute. That's right. I was thinking of something else. Go ahead. This is page 166 of Take Today.
Yeah. We are polluting art, capital A art, as fast as we are tidying up nature, capital N nature.
Now, what does that mean to you?
Let's see. What does McLuhan mean by art? It would be worth investigating that. Is he talking about all forms of media communications as being art form?
Yep. He's talking about the media environments inside the global theater. So the media environments themselves become art. Not hockey is not art. Painting is not art. Movies are not art. It's the media environments interacting, the interaction of them themselves, which is art. And he's saying we're polluting that.
He has a different concept of art. When I think of art, I think of you stand there and you look at something pretty that somebody made that's very sophisticated and finely crafted, and that makes it art. It's something that's something to be appreciated for its sake of contribution to beauty. Maybe enhances the sense of beauty in the soul or something like that. But now he's hijacking the word art here, I think, and using it differently.
Yes, the art that you're defining is a culturally limited view of Western Gutenberg values, right?
Mm-hmm.
Medieval art was used differently than what you just said. It may have served some level of beauty, but it had a whole different social function, and that was what anthropology and cultural studies started to see once the end of the 19th century, first part of the 20th century, started to get access to different cultural histories, and they began to say, what we call art, painting, music, that, it's different in different societies.
In the medieval times, art was used as a way of propping up Christian theology and the type of church morals and like that they wanted to...
It's iconic, but so McLuhan comes along and takes Wyndham Lewis's ideas of art and James Joyce's ideas of art and Eliot and Pound, and he kind of makes a synthesis and comes up with a new principle that art is anti-environmental. That means it offers perception on the immediate environment that you're hypnotized by. And then he says also the other aspect was that in a new environment, in looking back over the huge range of history in all the cultures, which he had access to information, building on the information of 50 years before him, he could see the pattern that when a new technology comes in, the previous society's environment, which was invisible, becomes visible, and that becomes a repository of the cultural values and becomes value in itself. So the process of the previous environment becoming an art form is another aspect of determining what art is. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's anti-environmental, and it is a process almost mechanical.
So here in 68 to 72, what media forms are anti-environmental art forms within the context of new technologies?
Okay, that's a good point. The interplay of the media, the actual interaction of them, is the anti-environment. We'll probably come to that quote. A rapid series of innovation is an ersatz anti-environment, right? An ersatz, a fake art, a rapid series of innovations. Now, the point is that you have rapid technologies changing, say from the 50s through the 80s, and they upset people's lives and have anti-environmental effects because people start seeing with such rapid change, you say, I was involved with that environment milieu, and now I'm involved with this environment milieu, and I can see the characteristics of the old one, but what's happening in the new one? So the 20th century experience led to people waking up because of the rapid turnover of innovations. Before the 20th century, innovation and the environments built from it were slower. so people couldn't see this process of the past becoming the art form or the repository of cultural value.
You know, a big distinction that I see when I was growing up was after color television came in, everything before that in black and white appeared to be sort of recontextualized as having this place in the past.
Right, but also aesthetes started celebrating the Hollywood before color TV, because the new environment always looks ugly, generally, and threatening, and so therefore the old environment becomes appreciated. So McLuhan said when TV came in, old movies, which weren't really considered anything more than just commercial trash and transient, they became art form, and you had the late movie put on TV. They were recycled as content of TV. And one way to look at that, besides the fact TV needs content, was that there was a new appreciation of the black and white movies as in any environment.
Plus, well, there were those movies that were probably always considered to be classics. They probably were great movies when they were played. They were considered great when they played in the theater, and they were probably considered great when they were recycled on TV. And then there were those B-grade movies that were just, Hollywood was just churning out in order to create content for theater.
But you have to look at the word art. The art form was ruled by highbrow literate people, and movies were not considered art. People, citizens, enjoyed them, but they were not considered art. They only became serious in the 50s by the cultural highbrows when French directors like Truffaut and Godard and these people started writing magazines with film criticism, like Cahiers du Cinéma, and they started taking these old directors seriously and developing the auteur theory. They started to emphasize the director, like they're projecting a Gutenbergian artistic genius, an individual, onto the movie tradition. And that was not how it was seen when movies were environmental in the teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s. So there was a whole movement in the late 40s, early 50s to re-examine art, re-examine movies in the highbrow art tradition. Now, what's interesting, by the 80s, literacy ain't ruling the roost anymore, so we don't know what art is, a nose highbrow imposed patterns anymore. And so that's just one side effect. So you got to remember the context that we're talking about here. Capillary art was presented as an elitist perceptual package. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so McLuhan is
so he's referring to capillary art here as his peers who are critiquing art would perceive art.
Before you say that, I want to. So when you were talking about people love movies, so they thought they were great then, and then they thought they were great when TV came on. No, we're not talking about movies as consumer happy, exciting events. We're talking about the role of art, and movies be considered art. And they were not considered art by the highbrow literati, even though there were art movements like Cubism, Dadaism, Surrealism, where they started to put the dirty media in their paintings. Chunks of newspaper and collage and that. They, the new artists, the radical artists, like Lewis Powell, Joyce, and Eliot, were bringing pop culture into the sacred church of capillary art. Okay, with that as a background, what did you say there?
So,
Lewin was using...
Yeah, he's using the word in this...
he's putting on the tradition
capital word, capital A art.
Yeah.
And he's speaking in terms that his peers who were art critics would understand art to be.
No, they didn't understand. He was putting them on and being in any environment to them. But he was right, so he had the edge. He predicted the way media in the art world, the capillary art world by the 70s and 80s, became a mixed media world. But that was still within the gallery art world. The museum...
That was like Warhol epitomized that.
Yes. There were many movements, but Warhol definitely was a figure in that. And, you know, like someone wrote that McLuhan was the Andy Warhol of big science. That's a neat statement. But you could say that Warhol was the Marshall McLuhan of gallery life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Of gallery, capital A, art world. But the point is that here, there's a meaning to the word art, and it ain't your usual meaning. And what he means here is the interaction of the environments inside the satellite environment, which on the commercial level is just a vulgar, rapid series of innovations. And
right.
people do get perceptional changes from the rapid series of innovations, but it is not defined coherently as McLuhan did. And so McLuhan's saying people are being changed, but they don't know why or how. And so we are polluting the rapid series of innovations, and if we consider perception of change as a valuable insight or valuable pattern, then we are polluting the ability for people to see why they are being changed by AirSat's media environments. So McLuhan said we could stop the pollution of art if we did media ecology. Modulate the environments. Turn TV off for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Just have newspapers. You know.
So he's saying we're polluting art by using it recklessly and unconsciously, developing new media technology,
yes.
implementing them without any.
Yes, and the radical change here is he's calling these media environments, who most people wouldn't consider art, he's calling that art. So he's being an outsider and a responsible insider at the same time. Now the interesting thing is, he's critiquing the eco people, the eco fascists, or the ecologist freaks. While everybody's trying to tidy up nature, he's pointing out that nature, capital N nature, is a product of the 18th and 19th century. It is not the environment we live in. The second nature is the world we live in, and that's art, the media environments. And so we're not even beginning to deal with pollution when we're trying to tidy up nature, because the real pollution is what he calls software pollution, which prevents any accurate way of dealing with nature pollution, because we're inside larger environments and handling the pollution of their effect first is what's required
mm-hmm.
before we talk about tidying up nature. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. But I don't think you can say that he thus invalidates the attempts of the ecology movement.
Oh, yes, he did. He said that the ecology movement was totally a reflex reaction to the satellite environment. He said the idea of planet Pluto, he made a pun on the ninth planet, Pluto, but he spelled it P-O-L-L-U-T-O. The image of the industrial environment polluting the Earth was a result of the Sputnik environment and the satellite environment. Now, the satellite environment turned...
That's not to deny that the industrial environment was polluting the Earth. It was polluting rivers. And
yes, but it was a minor pollution compared to the perceptual pollution caused by the rapid series of innovations and the effect of satellite and all that. In other words, while people were trying to tidy up nature, all their institutions were wiped out. And it was the institutional chaos that would frustrate any effort at pollution control on the industrial level. And many people would agree that we failed. They're now saying we got global warming, and, you know, Al Gore's out there with his movie saying we don't do something drastic, we're all doomed on the natural level. But the reason no one took anybody seriously for 30, 40 years was because the real pollution was in the information society. First, that had to be dealt with. So we are polluting art while trying to tidy up nature. And we got our priorities backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so the eco-environment people are just reacting to this process where when you experience a new environment, the old one becomes visible, and you start wanting to save the old environment. And the old environment was industrial mechanism. And you start looking at it, and you say, wow, that the pollution of that on nature, we didn't even notice for 100 years, or we didn't make it an issue. But since we're unconsciously in a new environment, we start to notice the old environment and say, we got to clean up industry.
Sure.
But it became a frustrated, imprecise, incomplete, unsuccessful operation. People could say, yeah, London, the car emissions are different now, so London's not as dirty. Lakes are being cleaned up now over the last 40 years. They've cleaned up things in certain parts of the world, and McLuhan predicted that we would caress the old first nature, planet Earth, and try to make it the pristine It contained the values that we projected in it while we were inside the new environment, which appeared ugly and had to, and was unmanageable and chaotic. That would be the rapid series of innovations.
So where I think LaRouche might attribute the problem with pollution and tidying up nature as being a feature of flaws within the philosophy of capitalism, and therefore giving in to human greed and the desire to accumulate wealth, personal wealth, McLuhan is saying he's not attributing it so
much. Fingers. Those would point fingers.
McLuhan is saying no. We would do the right thing if we knew what it was, but we can't see how we can't see what to do.
Yeah. Now McLuhan would say it's us doing it to ourselves, the super audience, you know, polluting itself, and LaRouche would point at certain oligarchs, point fingers at particular human groups, and say their ideas are here to allow this pollution to continue.
Yeah.
But LaRouche didn't believe in going back to nature or going back to earlier, simpler technological forms. He said the oligarchs were preventing the development of new. See, LaRouche is kind of the opposite. He said we need a rapid series of innovations, but not software innovations. We need new kinds of hardware, real valuable industrial machine tool development. That is what LaRouche thought would solve the pollution problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he did it with efficient causality around technology. McLuhan did it with the formal causality, looking at the effects of media that we do have and how they cause confusion and linguistic problems and flaws in communication about what the problems really are.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan was explaining why ecology or nature and its victimization by industry, that became a globally perceived situation thanks to the satellite. That was a service of the satellite. But then what do we do about it?
Yeah.
And we have the ongoing software pollution of the information environment.
Yeah.
So McLuhan complexifies it, right?
Yeah. So then the question becomes, if everybody voted for LaRouche and we implemented LaRouche's policies, would that have worked to clean up the problem? If everybody instead voted for McLuhan and everybody and we implemented McLuhan's policies, would that have cleaned up the problem? In other words, would either agenda be effective if everybody just got on the bandwagon and chose one and went with it?
Well, we should carry on here a little few more quotes in the course of answering that, because McLuhan, McLuhan would have allowed a situation where people could calm down and realize what the issues were and realize, okay, we don't need endless data and warnings. We'll turn off TV. Now we're maybe a little more sober, not overloaded by information and conflicting media. Now we can say, okay, what can we do to do this, to improve the society? Well, at that point, we'd be able to hear different proposals, and one of them would be LaRouche. You know, let's have more nuclear energy plants. Let's try to get coal fusion going. Let's have more machine tool stuff, and let's educate kids to not be into drug and sex and rock and roll, which they wouldn't because they wouldn't have the TV radio on so much. So they would like McLuhan's dropping that off, but McLuhan wouldn't do that go all the way because he'd want to bring TV and radio back eventually to balance off the hyper-literacy that LaRouche brought back in. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
But probably it didn't happen because it couldn't have happened. But if it did happen,
would the extreme of bringing back LaRouche's visual space also usher in prudish sexual values and?
No, LaRouche wouldn't advocate that. He believed in a sensuous engagement with reality, but he would not. He would say
you don't think that's
classical music, and if they listen to classical music, you know, he had a kind of media ecology. You listen to classical music and look at classic art and try to create new things along those lines, think up new science, that would engage people's energies and create a higher advanced technological society, and that would be sensuous involvement. Sex would be part of it, but it wouldn't be hyped up and exaggerated as it is in the...
So the fact that at the height of the visual space era, they were putting pant legs on piano legs, because they were too suggestive. You would say that that wasn't a feature of visual space itself.
Oh, no, that was a visual space society putting its bias on the multi-sensory implications of a shapely leg.
Yeah.
Remember,
so,
visual space people are a bit detached from multi-sensuous environment involvement.
Oh.
And sex is a potent force in a visually biased society because it's the one multi-sensuous activity they have.
Right.
But in a multi-sensuous society, which has a ground of multi-sensuous media, sex is just a cup of coffee. It's not a heady experience.
Yeah. Yeah, so LaRouche would not bring back visual space in that way.
And he's
still multi-sensuous in his visual space.
Yes, and the thing is, if you brought LaRouche and McLuhan in, I mean, they'd probably end up fighting each other because they do have different views of the issue,
mm-hmm.
you know? That would be a problem. I think McLuhan would have been, if I was the king, president, I would hire McLuhan to clarify the problem right now, which was software pollution. And then everybody said, oh, yeah, he's right, so let's modulate the media better, and turn it off, and realize that we're too obsessed with the book in our educational system, we're book people, we're ignoring the new media, and so we need to turn off the new media, realize our visual bias, then we can turn on the new media maybe a little bit and start to make it complex. But once you got that media thing understood, then you have to go to hardware reality. About oil and the pollution of old-fashioned industry, and we need new energy devices or new principles. Then you bring in LaRouche once the noise had been dampened down by McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? The noise of the software pollution, information overload environment.
Mm-hmm.
So you bring in LaRouche, and then there would be a lot of argument over whether that was real or not. But you can see in the in politics, you could say that. The Republicans, they believe in image, and a certain stable image, and the Democrats believe in unions and workers. So the Republicans are like, you know, a vulgar version of McLuhan, and the Democrats are a vulgar version of LaRouche, in the sense that the Republicans believe in image.
What do you mean image? Visual space? Visual space?
Yeah, the proper family values image, you know, rectitude in the image of America in relation to other countries. The argument over what that is among different factions of conservatism, you know, dissolves what I said. But in the end, it's the image of the White House that is building on the power of television, and that's what McLuhan would at least explain why that was happening.
Yeah.
Because politics is meant to reaffirm the institution of politics and the idea that there is a United States. The Democrats say, forget that image, superficial world, we will include that, but we need to feed families, improve our education, create, and bring in health care. Whereas the Republicans emphasize individual values and individual responsibility and initiative and all that stuff, right?
Right.
So it's, I'm just saying in general, the Republicans emphasize media image more than the Democrats, and the Democrats represent hardware development of individual brains, like LaRouche does.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But McLuhan and LaRouche are just two individuals. They're futile and puny compared to iconic institutions like the Republican Party and all its history and the Democratic Party, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those are images that they play off in the television vortex.
Right.
Okay, so let's go on to the next quote.
Yeah, well, just with respect to the last quote, we are polluting art as fast as we are tidying up nature. This is 1968 to 1972. So McLuhan is already thinking in terms of the global theater.
Oh, yeah, he's talking about the global theater in 68. It's the first time I see him write it. He does it in his McLuhan Dooline newsletter in 1968,
yeah.
Which he started in July. And he would have known about it a couple years before. It was just time to bring it out. He was always like a five-year plan. He had a whole bunch of stuff he'd say for 5 years, and then he'd move on to the next thing. But when he was saying something, he was working on what he would say next during the next two or three-year plan.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So when thinking about this...
Take Today is all about the global theater. That's the first book that discusses the global theater. And it didn't come out in 72, but it was written from 68 on. And you can see articles where he talks about the global theater in 68, 69, 70. Even in Cliché d'Archétype, which came out in 70, he he talks about the global theater. But it it's not really formalized in a big book form until Take Today.
Mm. Yeah. And so when we...
So that impresses you?
Well, when we pull this... when I think about this phrase, we are polluting art as fast as we are tidying up nature, when I think of that within the context of the global theater, then I can... It's easy for me to visualize the interplay of the, what do you call it, the mixed corporate media at that point?
Yeah.
The interplay of the mixed corporate media as being, you know, art form within the theater.
Right, that's why he hooked up Sending His Way, because there's a book that shows you the interplay of words and language and media. You don't get that in the singular English prose of a Wyndham Lewis, but it's the mixing of media that is really the real ground in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the mixing of media, which is the ersatz antivarmer, because nobody can stay attached to one media and its bias. They're always being upset by the next media coming in at them at the same time.
You know, and that sort of promotes to me the psychedelic effect, which maybe is what brought in the LSD and the desire.
Yes, the global theater, not television, it was what I call the global theater tactility. Television is a tactile medium on itself, but when you have the interplay of all the media inside the satellite environment, that is a psychedelic experience.
Yeah.
And so psychedelics came in the 60s, miming on a puny chemical body, you know, individual level,
right,
what was happening globally in a big sound light show, McLuhan called it.
Right. Yeah. Is you get synesthesia when these media start interplaying with each
other. Right. But here's the thing: one could identify with synesthesia, hook it up as a value. The problem is, though, that not even that, when you fully perceive the tactility of the global theater, is stable. The point is, you're getting the upsetting and the transient. It's like my chart shows this: the transient nature of each media experience. McLuhan writes about an understanding media, which shows you he knows that it's a global theater even then, because he says the modern man goes from the high blare of the radio soundtrack to the cool image of television to the kinetic rush of the car to the flat page of the book. And he just describes an average person's daily life in North America,
mm-hmm,
jumping from one media experience to another.
Yep.
And of course, today, you've got that on your internet and your little Palm Pilot, miniaturized. But back to this, it's the interplay and the upsetting. It's like, I don't think I have the quote in this book. I may, I'll find it, but I have it in my essay on McLuhan. He talks about people are hyper aware today because they can't stay stuck in one media bias because there's too many media environments demanding their attention. So that's the most hyper aware, hyper state of consciousness we could have that makes Gurdjieff, Alan Watts and Leary, puny guys who are still trying to make the individual aware, and whereas McLuhan is showing how we're more aware than any society ever could be or any advanced spiritual group. The problem is we don't know why we're aware or what the grammars are, and McLuhan becomes the guru of all gurus because he's telling you why you're hyper-aware.
Yeah.
And so compared to that, Leary, Bob Thurman, the Dalai Lama, the New Agers, the punk rockers, anybody has some chemical body agenda or astral body agenda, are puny.
Yeah. Problem is, I think too much awareness starts killing itself.
Well, that's why McLuhan said we'd go right-wing. He predicted that America would go right-wing. Remember, he's the only guy who predicted Reagan. In 1975, he says Reagan will be the perfect president because he's a man merged with his role. He's talking about Reagan in 75. And when Reagan came in, a lot of people in New York media remembered that. They were pretty impressed. But what was I saying but just before Reagan?
The implication being that his role is being demanded by the global theater, and so he's just...
McLuhan said that the global theater made everybody an actor. There was no audience. He said, everybody becomes crew, and there's no pastors. Because remember I said previously?
But are the roles predefined? The role that
the president of the White House.
Yeah, the role that Reagan assumed was a role that was being made by the mixed corporate media, and he stepped into it and assumed it.
No, it's the fact. McLuhan, the outrage about Reagan was this was an actor. But McLuhan knew that acting wasn't half the story. Everybody was an actor, whether they were in Hollywood or not. They were forced to be inside the Global Theater. All media environments were actors. And so he said, Reagan, and it was almost a joke the way he said it, as a put-on, he said, here's a man perfectly merged with his role. Well, role? Oh, yeah, that's because he's an actor. And so he's saying, a guy who's an actor is going to be the best candidate for president in the near future compared to an economist, a sociologist, or military guy. And nobody even realized that he was talking about the actor part of Reagan. Reagan was the best candidate because he was an actor, right?
And because we're in a global theater?
Yeah.
Which requires actors.
Yes. And if you're going to get a... If everybody becomes an actor, then you don't have any actors. Because everybody's one, so you can't decide. It's like, if everybody's an artist, then you don't know what art is. So if everybody's an actor and every medium is an actor, then we don't have actors. So then we will institutionalize the historical role of acting and give it the 19th century glorification treatment by sticking it in the White House. So we glorified the actor role when it was obsolete.
Wow.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah. You know, what's strange about it is that it has a peculiar literary bias to it, a visual space.
You're not saying what it is. What has the bias?
Well, the fact that McLuhan can speak about the global theater, I mean, behind every theater is the written word, the play.
Yeah, theater came in with visual space and the phonetic alphabet, as we know it. I mean, ritual was the theater before that, but it wasn't theater. It wasn't on a stage. It wasn't in a proscenium arch.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that...
Well, the fact that he's contextualizing in visual space terms what's happening...
to a visual space society.
Yeah.
It has his audience. He's talking to the West.
Yeah.
And the theater is the archetypal mental frame, almost, for the Western culture, Shakespeare and all that. And he said the satellite provided a proscenium arch, and the proscenium arch came in at the time of Shakespeare in the evolution of the structure of a theater. It was a new innovation. And so the proscenium arch became the effect of the satellite. And what is the satellite? It's looking down. It's an extension of the eye, almost. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's looking at space. You're in a rocket, you're looking. So you have a retrieval of theatrical space in the 60s. And then you have all kinds of popular responses to that, unconscious, in culture, across the board, that are responding to the media changes, to the television sensibility, the radio sensibility. So what did you have in the 60s? You had living theater, you had performance art, you had multimedia theatrical presentations, you had comedians becoming figures. You had all kinds of new ideas of how to do theater.
Yeah.
As attempts of ersatz innovations of the literary or of the cultural highbrows or cultural anarchists, whatever, responding to the effects of the global theater and totally oblivious to the role of the satellite in creating a global theater. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I wonder if McLuhan saw himself as being a man perfectly suited for fulfilling his role.
Oh, yeah, he saw that. He has references. He says, the artist has perfect pitch for his time. And he makes all kinds of statements. And critics have said this. Any scholars, they read McLuhan, they write a book on him, and they say, well, when he's saying this, he's talking about himself. And McLuhan did say one time, he said, I'm the only one who knows what's going on. He also said he was nostalgic for the days when people had big egos, like the Wyndham Lewis's and Pounds and Joyce's. And he would act that out a little bit in his own little theatrical references in different contexts. He would go around having a huge ego. He'd say things like, I'm the only one who knows what's going on. But he did know what was going on in spite of his little theatrical spurts. And the Reagan idea is an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
What was I going to say? I think I was going to say something else about the Reagan thing.
Yeah, Reagan what did you say? He was the perfect man to fulfill the role?
Yes, because he was merged with his role.
He was merged with his role. Now, and McLuhan would probably say that about himself.
No. McLuhan explained why people merge with their role, or why the image of being merged with your role was successful and charismatic. He was explaining why people and new notions and new attitudes were happening.
But he became a media guru, so he merged with his role. Maybe he did that as a
He didn't become a media guru. He would put on different styles of presenting himself within different media, and it would match with the media rules of that particular medium. So he would be conversational and relaxed when he was on a TV talk show. Mm-hmm. When he did a lecture, which is more of a what you would call a less cool, hot medium, where you are imposing your view on an audience and they're listening, sort of like an acoustic thing, not a tactile, cool TV talk show. When he was being more hot and acoustic in a literary context, he would talk very forcefully.
Yeah.
And then
people who work in media who didn't understand him in the larger context, the larger implications of what he was having to say, could probably learn from him about how to be effective in different media.
Yes, and many people did, and many people made millions of dollars using McLuhan, you know, polluted, vulgar versions of McLuhan.
Because
you remember, you have, by the late 60s, just when McLuhan's becoming really well-known, you still have the hangover from the literate society by the generation before the baby boomers who were managing society. They were built up on the values of highbrow literary standards, and they didn't even consider anything on television worthy of attention, and they were just still looking at the content. And so just the idea of having an ad or commercial without a linear story was revolutionary for them.
Mm-hmm.
They started to perceive a little bit about, well, we could have collage effects or put the people on a little bit. It became known as the soft sell, as opposed to the previous 50s, 40s, and 30s style of the hard sell.
Yeah.
So it went from hot fascism to cool fascism, if you want to get politically cynical about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, even Zappa has that on absolutely free. He says, here's the soft sell. There's a little section on the album called the soft sell. And he'd worked in advertising, so he knew of the term. So McLuhan influenced all kinds of people, and they got all kinds of ideas that they applied to content in their different fields, different media. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even Jack Nicholson says that when he read about the cliche and the archetype in McLuhan, I don't know where he read it, unless he read the book From Cliche to Archetype, he said that was a revelation to him in terms of his acting understanding.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a quote in an article interview with him.
Right.
You'd have to interview him and get the particular details. But the point is, he felt that McLuhan, whatever he thought McLuhan's concepts were about, he thought that they were very significant for his acting style. Okay, so let's move on to the next quote, because we're moving into a series of quotes here that are revolving around a theme. You know, remember I told you I'd have 3, 4, 5 quotes sort of illustrating a theme as we moved along in the stages of understanding McLuhan?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously we're moving into the post-global village, but global theater part of McLuhan's life in the 60s and early 70s, right?
And as we looked at last time, I think the global village is a violent place because it sucks the time and spaces out from between people.
Yeah.
And the global theater, does that increase that violence, or does the global theater, is there a shift in
terms of... It shifts to the violence of media. Media environments and media content become violent. And that's what happened in the late 60s, early 70s. That's when the New Hollywood, Dennis Hopper and those guys came in. They started presenting all kinds of violent stuff. Then you had the Clint Eastwood cowboy movies, right?
Yeah.
All kinds of things. The violence of the competition of the media, the gradually obsolescing media environments themselves, the media forms, have an identity crisis.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning of what I call the Android meme. And they become violent within themselves. They're no longer stabilized.
They don't even have any space to operate, to have any elbow room anymore. They're all in each other's face now.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That started in the late 60s. I remember reading a book in the late 70s by some, you know, prim, prudish art critic or sociologist, and he said, all the arts became violent. It was about the violence in the art from the late 60s into the 70s. And they blamed McLuhan for it. They said he advocated violence in the media. I mean, they had no clue about McLuhan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They thought because he commented on things that were happening that he was for them. They didn't even know what he was saying, let alone whether he had an opinion or not. But the they interpreted it as an opinion. And the fact that McLuhan was talking, they thought he identified with it. They didn't understand his detached, almost clinically scientific role as a social observer.
Yeah. Well, the chemical body seemed to need to point fingers.
Yeah.
Seems to have a need to point fingers.
Right. Now, the... okay, so we're talking about the... so I'm just saying this. It became a cliche that the arts became violent in the late 60s and early 70s, and that would be the effect of their own obsolescence inside the global theater tactility.
Mm-hmm.
So...
So in the next... So he's... He's satirizing that a bit in this next quote.
Yes.
The quote-unquote flower people.
No, exactly. That's a good point. It is, and now remember, this is from the book Cliched Archetype. From Cliched Archetype came out in 1970. This is page 184. He said, McLuhan says in the back of the flap of the book that this book is way beyond understanding media. Well, what he means by that is that we're in a different situation than we were when he wrote Understanding Media in the early 60s. We're into the global theater of media violence, where one cliché becomes archetype and then quickly becomes a cliché again,
mm-hmm.
right? The turnover of media forms. People are on the sidelines pretty well, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So what this quote says, you read the quote. I just want to read it, the previous quote, since I always replay it. So now that we understand the quote, let me read it, and everybody will really get it. We are polluting art as fast as we are tidying up nature. Now we go back to the slow version of reading with Scott.
Yeah.
And
now, in the quote you just read, he's still making a distinction here between capital N nature and art. I think later on, probably that distinction even begins to blur.
No, he talked about how they merged back in the 50s. The point is, this is a book. He's just a second. I had to do something here. He's putting on the words art and nature and creating a new pattern.
Mm.
He's no longer talking about art and nature merging and being obsolete. He's now saying, okay, people still think there's art, and they still think there's nature. So I'll reverse the aphorism and I'll say we're polluting art as fast as we're tidying up nature, because he knows that people think that artists, capital A artists, are sending out messages of save nature. But he's saying, no, those guys are just polluting art.
Okay.
So he's playing with words here and changing people's frameworks as the time demands it, and this being the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and so what, when he did...
this is after, you know, ecology has come up. I mean, he may not have composed this statement until 72 or just before the book was published, because... Ecology starts coming in big in the late 60s, early 70s. You have Earth Day established in 1970. So people are talking about tidying up nature for a couple of years anyways when he makes this statement. And he's immediately trying to lay out a figure ground in terms of that popular impulse.
Yeah. And in this next quote from Cliché to Archetype, in other words, still 1970.
Yeah, the hippies are still lingering as an image. You know, middle America, hippies go till early 70s. But as a media phenomenon in the big cities, it was over by 1970.
Oh.
But this book was written in 1966 to 70 because Life magazine did an article on McLuhan in 1966, and he mentions he's working on four books, and he mentions Cliched Archetype, he mentions Take the Day, but it's called Guide to Management or something at that point. And he mentions another book or two. I mean, these are books, they're coming out 5 years after they were conceived,
mm-hmm.
and worked on, you know. So in this book, page 184, what's he say? Cliched Archetype book.
The quote-unquote flower people, likewise, will soon take over the bureaucratic functions of state and army in order to propagate peace and Peter Pan.
Now, he's talking about the baby boomers, the TV generation, who are responding to the TV programming, TV conditioning. They wouldn't be aware of the satellite violence they'd just be reacting to it, which was the counterculture and the student revolution and all that stuff in the late 60s were, as McLuhan described. No? You there?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it phased out. McLuhan first used the term global theater describing the violence of 68. In the spring of 68, all the student riots were happening in Columbia and around the, in Germany and that, and he starts his the Dooline newsletter in the summer of 68, in July, and one of the first issues discusses, explains all this violence by kids in terms of the satellite effect, the global theater. So by 1970, he sees these, and he's saying that these kids are, they think they're arguing with television and the images on TV and Vietnam and all that, but he doesn't know that they're expressing a global identity crisis within media and within people as a result of the satellite environment, because that was the newest and latest environment. So he says these peace people, the flower people, are TV throwbacks who are still trying to have, they're actually trying to recover the placidity of the 50s, which was the effect of the TV when it was ground. So they will take over the bureaucratic function of state and army because they're largely literate, industrialized people, so they still think in bureaucratic terms, and they'll do this in the United States and Canada, and they'll propagate images of peace and Peter Pan. And Peter Pan was an image, I think he got that from Wyndham Lewis, I'm not sure. But Peter Pan was his put-down image for all the corporate executives who turned all the populations into discarnate, disembodied, flying people. And therefore they were Peter Pan, teaching people how to fly, right?
Yeah.
And that was the unconscious effect of the discarnate state of electric environment. And so